From the heart of the Forest City, focusing on the biggest stories in London, this is the Craig Needles Podcast. Now here's your host, Craig Needles.
Here on a Friday on Richmond Row, and of course, it's all powered on the podcast here by our friends over at Downtown London and the Covent Garden Market. We are not at the market just yet. We are still waiting on our supply chain issues. We will be there soon, but so we're recording from our Richmond Row studio today and joined here in the studio by Sean Lewis, the Deputy Mayor of London, Kelly Zigner, who is the CEO of the Elgin Middlesex United Way, and Jared Zafman, CEO, London Home Builders Association. Hello, everybody. Thank you for being here today.
Hello. Hey, happy Friday. Now, what you mean by supply chain issues is that Cheryl Miller's chair hasn't shown up yet, right? Okay.
I will say this, thanks to our friends over at Lazy Boy, we do have a nicely furnished podcast space there right now. However, we are awaiting microphones from friends who I will not name.
Kind of important.
Yeah. Microphones are a legitimately significant part of what we're doing around here.
And Craig, I don't know if I can just say very quickly, but as a former board member with the Covent Garden Market and chair, super exciting to have you guys down there and in that space now.
I am thrilled to be there. And I know that, when I had John on the air on Classic Rock 98.1 this week, and I know the board's thrilled to have us there, and I know the management is thrilled to have us there. We had Amy on the air. Really exciting, and some really cool stuff's going on at the market, and we want to be there for a whole lot of it, and we are going to be. And I've already talked about me getting into the wrestling ring at Taco Fest. We'll see how that goes. I want to at least be special guest referee. We're trying to work that out. Let's get to our stories of the week, and the big one was various discussions surrounding housing. So there is a piece in the London Free Press this week that I'm sure you all saw, where it said, hey, we're building a lot of homes in London. That's great, but we need to build more than we are. We'll get to the province's end of this in a second. But Jared, your thoughts on building a lot of homes and whether we need to build more. Are you pro or against?
Very, very pro, as you might imagine. Yeah, surprise. And certainly our members do as well. They are, sort of chomping at the bit, ready and waiting to build homes. One of the challenges has simply been that for builders, it's difficult when you put a ton of money into houses that people are not there to purchase. And that's really, unfortunately, what we've been seeing over the last year and a half, really driven by interest rates, I would say. It's trying to find the right timing of everything to make sure that the buyers are going to be there for the homes that they're going to build and invest in.
That's interesting because we hear that there's a shortage, and of course there is a shortage, but at the same time, the price points are so high because there's a shortage, it leads to a kind of a strange supply issues. So, Sean, what's the city doing in order to get these buildings done quicker?
Well, first of all, I completely agree with Jared. Like, yes, we want more homes built, and we want them built as fast as possible. The number one driver of affordability and pricing, frankly, is the lack of inventory. And so the more shovels we get in the ground, the more housing we get built, the more we will see the cost level off as well. Now, the interest rates, I agree with Jared, they've been a big barrier. They've kind of leveled off for the last 6 months or so, and I think that is indicated, in the Free Press article that you were referencing. Permits are starting to get pulled now, so approvals that were given a year ago, now that the interest rates have at least stabilized and aren't continuing that upward trend, now we're starting to see those permits get pulled and the construction start, because it's still viable to build these homes where the interest rates are. The price point's going to be higher for the purchaser, but people are still going to be able to buy them. The bigger concern for me, and of course I want those single family and I want the townhouses and those sort of medium density developments, but the purpose-built rental is really, really low in terms of inventory, and we really need to address that. And we are, there's 20 cranes in the sky right now in London. Mm-hmm. So that's great news. There's never been 20 cranes in the sky in my living memory for the city. So it's great that we're getting those units. But, high rises are a 2 to 3 year timeline horizon from shovels in the ground to somebody being able to move in. So yep. Those things take time.
I walk by Centro every day, and hey, it's coming along. It looks great. But they had started this when I started working here, and I've been working here for 3 years.
Yeah. The York Acqui development on King, right? They're leasing now, but that started in the last term of council. It didn't start in this term of council. And so we're starting to see the rewards. We're reaping those rewards now of the work that's happened 3 or 4 years ago. But that's because these things take time. And I guarantee if Jared had a machine he could order off of Amazon that drove down a new road and plopped out homes, he'd order one today. It'd be worth his money. But he doesn't. He's got to have contractors come in and do the labor, the skilled trades, have to do the plumbing and the electrical and everything. So these things do take time. Mm-hmm. And there are some barriers from senior levels of government that are a reality here too. But I think both our local development industry and our council are really pushing to get this moving as fast as we can. And all sorts of homes, from high-rise apartments to mid-rises to townhomes to single-family homes, right across the spectrum. And I think the other thing that we need to keep in mind is we're starting to do our land needs assessment reviews because one of the realities that we are going to have to face is that we are running out of developable land within the urban growth boundary. And we are going to have to start bringing new land, still land in the city limits. We're not talking about annexing Dorchester just yet. Kelly Elliott, please don't get mad at me. I'm not coming for annexation yet. But we do have land within the city that is still outside the urban growth boundary, and we're going to have to look at bringing some of that in so we can start to develop housing there too.
Just from context for some of the things that Sean just said, and you touched on a bunch of things that were discussed on this podcast on Tuesday with failed liberal academic Mike Moffitt.
Excellent podcast, by the way.
Go back and listen to that once you're done with this one if you want some real context on some of the urban growth boundary issues that Sean was talking about and the skilled trade shortage issues that Sean was talking about, because we talked about both those things quite a bit. Kelly, where do you think that the community's at right now? Because, look, we all know there's a housing crisis. We all want to see more housing get built. But I think that for a lot of people, that's kind of like an arm's length thing because they're not in this every day like Shauna is in, and Jared is.
Yeah, you know, at United Way, of course, we're focused on the lower end of the housing spectrum. What is encouraging in London is that, you know, the community and council have their view on the entire spectrum. It's not just, you know, we're not just building what they call McMansions in the suburbs. Like, there is this range of housing being made available. I think there are some provincial legislative bits that are a challenge. One, the cap on rent control. So, you know, these great high rises are going to go up.
OW and ODSP.
Yeah, well, of course,
those
that
are
too.
Good one, yep.
But you know, those rent caps, that's going to be a reality for people. People are going to get priced out of those markets pretty quickly. And then another policy that I've sort of been watching and will probably be of interest to you, Craig, because I see you tweeting your bingo card on NIMBYism all the time, is you know, I've seen provinces like BC where they've introduced legislation where if as long as something is within the city's official plan, they don't have to hold PPMs or public participation meetings to be able to accelerate some of the development.
I can think of one person in this room and 14 of their colleagues that may like the idea of not having to hold PPMs on certain things.
Love it. And I'm glad you brought that up, Kelly, because so at planning next week, there's an application coming forward from Ironstone to do 142 townhouses up on Superior Drive. Everybody's up in arms on the street. Oh my God, not townhouses in our single family home neighborhood. This was supposed to be a school block. You need to build a school there. The school board passed on that school block. We can't make the school board build a school anywhere. No. Believe me, if we could, there's a few other locations that would be more prioritized than that one. You know, the project is innovative. It looks good. The buildings are designed to look like the rest of the buildings in the neighborhood. Yeah. And they're building two-story towns. They could go up to 3.5 story. They could do stacks, mm-hmm. and they're not. They're keeping them at two stories. And yet we've got this massive NIMBY pushback. Most of it is all form letter copy and paste. There's very few original letters. And so it's hard to take that seriously. And then we sit in council chambers and listen to 20 people get up and read from the email they already sent us that we've already read, and spend 5 minutes reading to us the piece that they've already submitted. That's not really helpful. It's not a great use of our time. It's not a great use of staff's time, for sure. They could actually be working on planning applications that need approvals, getting building permits ready to get out the door. So the NIMBY factor is a big one.
I'll just say also, I mean, from an industry perspective, Sean's kind of made a couple points on this, but I mean, council has done a really excellent job trying to get approvals through. I think everyone's always looking for faster timelines as much as possible. Always some challenges, unfortunately, and we're working on that, I think, with building division and timelines there. We still have an average permit timeline of 33.3 days now. It was 43.3, so that's a big improvement. But, you know, to Kelly's point, too, I mean, opportunities where, you know, council will ultimately have to deal with NIMBY pushback on applications, which in my opinion, and I think from many people's opinions, will be very reasonable from an intensification perspective, from an infill perspective, from a vacant piece of land. And, you know, it's not just council priority. I mean, I think it's the community's priority as well, that we need more homes of all types, including this type specifically, which, you know, for a lot of people is affordable and something they can actually get into. You know, we need all kinds of homes, single family homes, townhomes, duplexes, triplexes, stack towns, apartment buildings, which we're seeing a lot of. But to Sean's point as well, oftentimes with those larger, higher density projects, that's where we see longer timelines. And when those things tend to, you know, when the permit hits, that's, you know, that project has been in the pipeline and working on it for a long time. And certainly I know, Craig, you mentioned we'll talk about the provincial matters there. But, you know, a lot of municipalities that have benefited from some of the changes at the provincial level from a funding perspective have happened to have projects that hit the timeline and hit that permit timeline in the right year and the right time. And we've been unfortunate in London to be out of that last year.
Yeah. And we also, you know, when you're talking about those things, I think the other thing that we really, and I've talked to Peter Devlin about this. I've mentioned it to Peter White up at Western as well. You know, there's also a real need to have people graduating from programs that we can actually hire them at the city to evaluate planning applications to help us get building permits out the door. There is a staffing challenge on our side too. I'm not going to deny that. I think that having our staff come back to work in person in the office 4 days a week is making a difference in terms of those timelines, getting down from 43 to 33. There's still room for improvement on that. But there are some real challenges too with having people take the programs of study that lead to these jobs so that they can continue to help us do this.
Kelly, you mentioned obviously the lower end spectrum of that of the affordability for housing, and that's a big thing. And, you know, we're talking about this and like, hey, this is what the plan should be and here's where this should go. But there are people who are struggling right now in this moment, and they're in a bad way, and the affordability of housing just isn't there for them. So it kind of like we're talking about this, and these problems need to be addressed. But at the same time, the urgency of it, really, it's hard to even possibly come up to where the urgency is, right?
Yeah, it is. It's pretty wild. I mean, people, you know, we're doing, you know, work on sort of the hubs and sort of stabilizing people, but you have to have places for folks to go, and there really aren't a lot of options. And, you know, I'm hearing, you know, even what used to be sort of like student rentals and student housing in and around Western are now, you know, being sort of populated by folks that aren't in school, right? It's just anywhere you can get somewhere to live on for a reasonable amount of money. And if you're on social assistance, well, that becomes darn near impossible for folks.
Yeah.
Well, and some of that's going to require some different expectations from people in the short term, at least in terms of how they can help self-resolve. Like, you know, there's going to be cases where, you know, family members are going to have to share a place instead of having individual apartment units. Or, and I know that that's happened in a rent eviction situation that I'm aware of, where a mother and a daughter had two separate units, and now they're sharing a two-bedroom unit instead. To combined, they can afford it. Apart, they were no longer in a position to manage. And so some of that is going to have to be, like, government's not going to solve this on our own.
Right. Nope. Yeah.
And social agencies aren't going to solve this on their own. And the private sector's not going to solve this on their own. And some of it is going to require people to find some different ways to have expectations. People are going to have to find roommates. People are going to have to, you know, look at, you know, basement granny flats or backyard alternate residential units as smaller footprints than what they may have had, because these things are going to take time. They're not going to be there's no overnight fix for this.
Yeah.
Oh, and I mean, you know, we're seeing in London, well, we've seen it for the last number of years, but I mean, our population growth has gone tremendously, which makes, you know, more people that are in the market looking for the same amount of supply that exists. And so the idea of being able to add additional residential units, as Sean spoke to, being able to intensify, you know, an existing property certainly adds more ability for people to be able to more people to live in one place and make it more affordable. But at the same time, you know, there's just this overall challenge where, you know, it was not more than 5-6 years ago where the average price of a home in London was around $300,000-$350,000. Now, you know, we're at a baseline of about $650,700 on the resale market. And let alone when you're looking at new builds, unfortunately, since pre-pandemic levels, the 2,400 square foot home average, and this is from Chubb Insurance, but the average cost to build a home simply has gone up $65,000. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, from pre-pandemic levels, and that's not coming down, partly because of materials and where material providers are keeping those costs, but also because of the shortage of skilled trades. And that's something we're trying to work on constantly, because we know now and into the future we're going to need those. Otherwise, you know, the even the supply chain of people is going to be in higher demand, which would lead to even higher prices.
Well, I talked about the Superior Drive application, and I know what the purchase price was of those single family homes, and the townhomes are going to cost what those single family homes cost when those people purchased them and now are saying, oh, we don't want lower income people living around us, people who can only afford a townhome. Those folks are paying the same as you paid for your single family home, because the cost of housing is not what it was 4 years ago.
And a lot of the people saying, oh, I've lived here for 20 years. Yeah. Like, guess what the cost of your house was 20 years ago? The hell of a lot less than this townhome's going to be now.
And I want to come back to the NIMBY thing for a minute. You know, counselors, there are some counselors who are going to need to grow a spine, frankly, in terms of pushing back against some NIMBYism in their wards. And I'm not afraid to say that, because I'm willing to do it myself. I've got an application coming for some townhouses on a vacant lot in my ward right now, where I had neighbors objecting because the townhouses are going to be two stories and their homes are one and a half story. Mm-hmm. And where am I going to walk my dog now? Because I've been using that vacant lot at the end of the street to walk my dog. Well, it was never your vacant lot, and half a story difference is not... You know, it's not going to radically alter the neighborhood. It's not going to change your life at all once the construction. Yes, there'll be some construction disruption. That's part of living in a city. There's construction disruption. It feels like the whole city's under construction right now.
Yep.
But that is where counselors are going to have to take a bigger picture view, step back from the concerns of you know, a dozen or two dozen residents on a street, and look at what is best for the city overall. Look at what is best for the budget overall in the end, because it's far more expensive to take care of people who don't have housing than it is to have housing built for them and move forward and then collect the property taxes from those houses. So there's some counselors who are going to have to develop a bit of a tougher skin when it comes to the NIMBY pushback, because a lot of these things are perfectly reasonable fits for the neighborhood.
I will say this, and you know, I've obviously covered things at London City Hall for a long time, and I've covered a lot of planning meetings and whatnot. And I've been to a bunch of planning meetings where it's like, okay, it's 14-1, and the ward counselor votes against this, and you're like, okay, fine. But like when those votes, instead of 14-1, it's like, well, wait, why was this 9-7 or 9-6 rather? Why was this 10-5? You know what I mean? It's just like we've got to just like not listen to some of this and not fan the flames.
Exactly. And frankly, if I was somebody who was, you know, unhappy with the rate of housing development in my area, if I thought it was, you know, and it doesn't matter like whether it's an apartment building downtown or a 100 unit townhouse complex out in the East End or whatever it might be, if I'm not really happy with my ward counselor and I wanted to go into the next election as a challenger, I'd look at those places where the ward counselor opposed that infill, and I'd go to those buildings, I'd go to those townhomes and say, how do you like living here? You know, your ward counselor didn't want you to have a home here.
Yeah.
Like, those are going to be new residents who will be supportive of you and will bring their concerns and issues as well, but hopefully will also support you in your election time when people are occupying those places. So, you know, it's, you defend NIMBY now, it might come back to bite you in the ass later.
Well, right. Just to Sean's point, I mean, I think they need to now, especially because if not, and it's going to become very critical in the near future, but hasn't come forward yet, but we are looking at an entirely new zoning bylaw for the City of London and potential amendments to the official plan for the city, which will simply allow, hopefully anyways, for much higher intensity usage and much higher density usage across the city, where, you know, there may not even be these opportunities for NIMBY pushback, because it's simply going to be the law of the land, which is going to be necessary to be able to grow the city as fast and as quickly as we're going to need to be able to accommodate population growth, but also build in a more affordable way.
Yeah, and it can't just be those primary transit corridors. When I look at Oxford Street, or I look at Commissioner's Road, or I look at Dundas Street out in my ward, you know, fronting arterial roads like that, you shouldn't be capped. If the servicing is there, you should not be capped at like four stories or six, like 12. Let's do 12 as of right, something to that effect, where you can get that density, because you do have to have the economies of scale on these things, right, too. I know builders and right now.
The whole selling point on bus rapid transit was, hey, we're going to build up a lot of intense housing around this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bus rapid transit is going down Oxford.
Yeah. Well, yes. It's going down Wellington, right? And we've seen Auburn and Drulo project, the Century project, on some single-story commercial land that is now going to become a mixed use with lots and 1,200, 190 residential units, I think, there. White Oaks Mall has been purchased, and the new owner is looking at putting some high-rises on the mall property. Those are all good things. Yep. But it doesn't have to just be the rapid transit lines.
We need the
high-rises
there more than we need the parking garage that only gets used on Saturdays in December.
Yeah.
That's the only time that parking garage ever gets used.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, but not just the rapid transit corridors. Your primary arterial roads, your Oxford Streets, your Commissioner's Roads, your Wonderland Roads, your Dundas Streets, east of the core, obviously, because in the core we're already pretty full up. But those are the places where we should be looking for the higher heights, the bigger densities. It's where the amenities and access to transportation services and all those things already are within easy reach. So we have to look beyond what's there today and think about what should be there 10 years from now.
Kelly, do you want to add on that before we go on to the forward part of this?
And just that infill is always cheaper, right? And more cost effective. And so everyone's, hollering about the tax rate right now. Yeah. Well, if you keep spreading out further and having to develop new land, it's a lot more expensive.
You're going to get more of those 8.8% bumps, or 8.7% bumps, I should say. The province had their Building Homes Faster Act, and they had promised some money from municipalities who were building homes faster. And Sean, City of London, Getney. Why did that happen, and how do you feel about it? Maybe not good.
Well, not thrilled with it.
Yeah.
I think that the province has... The problem is that they're using a measurement that's just capturing a point in time, and it's not considering the... Particularly on the high-density stuff, which is what we really are aiming for, it's not considering the length of time that construction takes to build these things out. And so if you've got a project like Centro... that was started before the Building Faster Fund was even announced, but it's not yet complete. So that should count when people are moving in, not when the program started. So there's this point in time measurement, it's not a good measurement. It's also tricky because municipalities, as Jared would know, we can't force his builders to pull a building permit. We can give them all the permissions, give them the zoning bylaw amendments that they need to build. But they can sit there for months before the conditions are right, before they can sometimes line up contractors to do the work or get the supplies to do the work. So that's not the municipality's fault. And that's where this measure is not really reflecting the municipalities that are really building fast. Now, I will say I've been very encouraged, and I've had an opportunity, and I know the mayor's had an opportunity to talk to Minister Flack, the Associate Minister of Housing, and they recognize, a number of municipalities aren't qualifying. Not all the money that they were going to, that they had hoped to get out the door, is going to get out the door under the goalposts that they have right now. But they are going to also be opening a door for applications to come in that didn't meet the criteria, but are nonetheless developed around infrastructure needs for that housing to progress. So if we can submit an application in April that says, hey, from that money that's left over, we need $50 million for new sewer and water mains, I'm okay with that. And I appreciate the fact that they're still listening to us. Obviously, I would have liked to have just gotten the money up front, but we can find ways to work with them on this. And the fact that they're continuing the discussions is encouraging. If we were just getting the door slammed in our face, I would feel I'd have a lot more Cheryl Miller words coming out of my mouth and be a little less diplomatic about things, but they haven't. They've kept the door open. They're having discussions with us on how they can help move things forward still. So I'm encouraged, and I think that London will get some funding out of that in the next couple of months.
And I think, it's interesting to see, this is obviously a different tactic that the province has taken than we've ever seen before. And I think we're encouraged by a lot of the actions that the provincial government has taken related to housing. I mean, all really in an effort to try and encourage more housing to get built, maybe not getting everything perfect, but, trying to encourage, and certainly we've seen from council, from staff for sure, that there's a level of urgency that I think this has really put forward amongst everybody. And from the builder side, I mean, it's challenging because we're, again, people aren't going to build when there's not people that are going to buy. But, I think we certainly right now are seeing the market certainly pick up here in London specifically. Certainly on the resale side, that's been going very hot lately. And on the new build side, I mean, our builders are seeing a lot more interest than they've seen in the last year. So there's a lot of opportunity, I think, excitement to come, and it's just keeping on that momentum. But we're hopeful, and even still, that there's maybe some other ways that even the province beyond this has other measures that can help expedite some of the building to come, especially when it comes to rigor and regulation and restrictions, where is everything always necessary what's currently in place? And certainly even from the building division, even from planning staff, I mean, council has, you know, put forward and approved so many applications in the last year, which is great to see, and units that will be able to get built. And I think we want to see that trend continue, even improve where possible, and, you know, continue to make sure timelines are continually improving. I mean, we're a different beast than Middlesex Center, for example, but still get a lot of refrain from a lot of our builders, which is, I'd much rather just go out and build a Middlesex Center because my timelines are going to be way faster than the City of London. And there's lots of room for improvement there.
You're not the first person who's ever said that on this podcast, by the way.
Yeah, that exurban growth, that exurban growth is a real, real negative. And that's where, when we talk about the urban growth boundary, people need to keep in mind, it is much better to expand where we're building within the city limits than push people out to the Dorchesters and the Thorndales and the Kamokas and then have them commuting into the city every day, not paying any property taxes here to support the infrastructure. A longer commute, so a bigger greenhouse gas footprint in terms of climate change issues, still relying on all the, you know, coming into town to use our arenas and our swimming pools and all those things and paying a user fee, but not contributing in any way through the property tax base. That is a far worse option than bringing a little bit more land inside the urban growth boundary and letting building happen within the city where the city is then realizing the revenue. I know the county is happy to take their revenue, but if we're going to continue to support all the amenities for these folks, we need the revenue here in the city. So that exurban growth absolutely is a challenge that we cannot forget when we're talking about where and how fast we're allowing development to happen in the city.
Yeah, I think that's a good spot to leave that particular conversation. I want to talk LCBO just on provincial issues, but first I want to get to a Twitter thread that Kelly did this week about drivers here in the City of London and them not, you know, doing very well at it. Kelly, I saw you tweet this out. I'm like, I want to talk about this. You already agreed to come on the show this week, but when I saw you tweet it out, I wanted to talk about it because, you know, you mentioned a few different things you had seen, and you're noting that you feel as though it's getting worse in the city as far as the way people carry on behind the wheel. Just explain your thought process behind that.
Well, first off, I'll say, like, I'm not going to say I'm a perfect driver. Everybody has flaws and makes mistakes when they drive.
Yep.
But this is not that. This is not, you know, the person who, you know, stopped too late at the stop sign. This is like utter lawlessness. I go to the gym every morning at 5 a.m. I'm one of those silly people. Ew. And, you know, there's like literally nobody on the road. And so I don't know if it just stands out more to me because I'm the only one out there.
Or do people think they can do whatever they want because there's no one
but
on the road?
Like, you know, yesterday I'm driving home from the gym at 6 a.m. It's dark out. I'm behind a car, no lights on, not maintaining any speed. And then I can see on his dash, he's got it like a YouTube video or a video chat going because his phone is on there. And it's just like lots and lots of that stuff, really aggressive drivers, like you're stopped at a stoplight and they're coming out around you to go right in front of you when you're the first one in line. Like, it's just, that's the kind of stuff that's really making me scratch my head right now and making, I think it's making all road users unsafe and particularly those who are vulnerable, like those on bikes and pedestrians.
Everything you said and then some, and it's not just at 5 a.m, although I'm pretty sure that that's actually a mythical time that you've just made up.
No, I can say that's not true for my 6 week stint coming in here for the morning.
Right.
Show.
Yeah.
It's terrible at all times of the day in all parts of the city. And I've seen it too. The jumping out in front of people and making a right turn on a red, like there's nowhere you're going that's that important to risk people's lives. Passing a stop school bus with the stop arm out while kids are getting on or off a school bus. That kind of behavior is running rampant. I had another car on Admiral Drive just jump the curb and crash into a house because they were going too fast and they hit another car along the way. It's a 40-kilometer zone. And listen, I saw the front door video cam from one of the neighbors, and that individual was not going anywhere close to 40 kilometers an hour. I don't want to judge what speed it was, but it was not 40. So very, very, and now we've got to put speed bumps in over there. Neighbors are happy, but really I would prefer if people just learned how to drive properly rather than spend money on traffic calming measures like speed humps. I see it everywhere too, Kelly. I'm so frustrated. It was just a couple weeks ago I did a post on social media that was just like slow down, like I'm tired of this. And this is part of the reason why, you know, I feel like I've talked about this forever, so I'm not going to spend too much time on it. But this is why the police budget was important, because we need traffic enforcement division back up and properly staffed. We can't have two or three officers for a city of 500,000 on traffic enforcement on a shift, right, and everybody else responding to 911 calls. We need dozens of them out there on traffic enforcement.
And I agree with that point. I want to expand on it a little bit. Jared, your thoughts on where drivers are at right now?
I mean, Sean was going to made a point that I was certainly one of them I was going to make, which I think this is a multifaceted issue, right? I don't think it's one simple thing. But I do think that, one, having more, you know, eyes on the street and from the police perspective. I mean, I think I've personally noticed it where there's visibly less of a presence of police on the road at you know, traffic stops and those sorts of other things, that I think just, you know, mentally put that in people's psyches where it's like, well, actually, I need to be careful here because, yeah, I'm going to get caught. And right now I feel like there is certainly a bit of that where if people feel like I don't really need to worry about that. I think, you know, measures like red light cameras, you got the speed cameras in school zones. There are some factors where, you know, that's a permanent, or it can be transported, but for a time anyways, a permanent fixture. Even then, though, I feel like people still don't necessarily care because it's not something visibly, someone they can see, a police officer that's going to keep an eye out on them. And then I think, you know, I remember, I don't know if it was a CBC story or somewhere else about, you know, how, I can't remember, is it the rate of a driver exams that have been passed now? And, you know, what is the quality of driver education and of drivers mm-hmm. these days? I don't know, that's another issue, I think.
Yep.
And frankly, I think it's just a broader, I don't know, societal issue where it's sort of a selfish.
I don't care as much about the people around me.
Yeah, which again, yeah, when you're, yeah. I recall when I was 16 learning how to drive. I mean, the big factor is like, look out for everybody on the road. And I'm sure that's still part of driver's ed, but I feel like that's been lost on a lot of people where it's just, I need to get where I need to get to. Everyone else get out of my way. I don't really care what's going to happen. And that's, I think, why we're seeing a lot of these problems.
Yeah. I will say this, and Sean, you've talked on this podcast before, and when I was doing the radio thing several times about, hey, let's get some more photo radar out there. I'm a big believer in that, especially in school zones. Put it up, and no signage telling anyone it's coming. Just goes up. If you speed in a school zone, sorry about your ticket.
Yeah, get rid of those 90 days of yep. warning before we actually turn the cameras on.
Nope.
Man, I wish the province would let us put them in places other than school zones.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
There are other places they're needed. We yeah. should be able to have them wherever the police have identified a need for them.
Yep. And you bring up the police, and I think that's important because I saw some of the reaction to Kelly's Twitter there being, well, London police don't care about this. I know that's not true. And I think that there were some very reasonable and rational criticisms of the way that the police budget was rolled out. And we've talked about that in the podcast before. However, when Ali Chabar and Chief Tai Trung were here in this studio, they spent quite a bit of time with me talking about, hey, these 94 whatever new officers that we're going to hire with this, a significant percentage of them are going to go into traffic enforcement because we know we are not filling out our end of the bargain there. We've got to have more people doing traffic enforcement because there are some negative things happening on London streets because of that. So this is very much on the radar of London police. It's something they want to address here. Now, the issue is, will you be able to address it with what you've asked for here and the significant expenditure that comes from that? We'll see. I think it will be a negative situation if they can't, but they are at least making an effort to address this. I don't think there's any way around that. So I am glad to see that that is a priority. However, I think that traffic safety advocates would point out that you can have all the police officers you want. If you have drivers with a bad attitude and you have, in some cases, roads that are poorly designed, it won't matter how many police officers you have out on the road. And I agree with that too. So there needs to be a driver attitude shift. And in some cases there needs to be, and I know that the city is looking at this. Sean has done this in a few different spots, specifically in Ward 2, and you and I have talked about them, where, okay, we can thin this road out a little bit here, kind of have, you know, this happen here. So there is less of a street race track mentality in some of these spots, right?
Yeah. Well, so when you're retrofitting existing neighborhoods, when you're coming in and building the more complete neighborhoods with new sidewalks, right? Curb facing sidewalks that narrow the road instead of cutting somebody's driveway and front lawn up and putting the sidewalk 3 feet in. No, you actually narrow the road by 3 feet and put the sidewalk on the curb facing side. I can tell you there's a couple of streets in my ward where there's been a noticeable decrease in speed as a result of that. And I'll take that all day long. Wavell Street, where I live, since the protected bike lanes have gone in, The result of not having that center turn lane has reduced the speeds on average 7 to 8 kilometers an hour. That's significant. That's a 40 kilometer zone, two schools, mm-hmm. and we were tracking speeds well over 60 kilometers an hour at some parts of the day. Those are now below 50, and around the school hours, it's much closer to 40. It's still over 40, but it's much closer to 40 than it was. So those road narrowings do work to some degree. Of course, we got about 4,000 kilometers of road in the city. We can't retrofit every road, you know, come back to that 8.7% budget. We're not going in with a bunch of concrete and construction workers because they're pouring foundations for houses to narrow roads right now. So there's a societal change that needs to happen. I don't know when people stopped caring about the rules of the road, but I do know that when there are police out there, there is a halo effect that comes from seeing a police officer having a car pulled over that makes people slow the hell down. Mm-hmm. And not just in the moment, but they tend to watch their speed the rest of the day. And if they see that happening every day on their commute, every day picking up their kid from school, every day coming home from the hockey game or the soccer game, then it's going to, I think, influence driver behavior to be a little bit better. I think the other thing we need to factor in is red light cameras. The city has purchased more. We're waiting for them to arrive. We've got supply chain issues too. Mm-hmm. The photo radar right now, even though I'd love to have like triple what we've got and be able to put them outside of school zones, all the photos and all the fines have to get processed through a single processing center in Toronto for every municipality in this province. Oh,
why?
There's not a lot of capacity right now for them to take on more red light camera or more photo radar processing.
That just seems like an unnecessary bottleneck. There's ways around
it. Yeah, it does. Yeah. And that's something that I think we really need to revisit with the province is and through AMO, like because every municipality is in the same boat. We can't expand the program because we can't process tickets any faster. So I think that there needs to be, you know, some investment made there that sort of separates those out. Maybe it's regional, Northern Ontario, Southwestern Ontario, Eastern Ontario, GTA, each get a processing center. but that's a bottleneck too. So, and I don't know, like maybe the answer at the end of the day, and I can't believe I'm saying this because I don't believe in teaching the robots anything more than they already know because Hollywood has taught us that that never turns out well for the meat-based life forms on this planet. Yeah. But, you know, the AIs need to start taking over. Maybe we need speed governors on cars like we have on trucks. If people aren't going to obey the rules of the road properly, there may be things we can do in terms of regulatory framework, not we as a city, but as a nation. The federal government could impose some regulatory measures on auto manufacturers that say, you know, certain things aren't allowed. Well, who needs a car that can go 180 kilometers an hour?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
There's no speed limit in this country that's 180 kilometers an hour. So why is a car allowed to be sold that can go 180 kilometers an hour?
Fair question. Come with me if you want to live. Is exactly what I want my driver to be saying to me as we get into a vehicle.
One other thing on this, Craig, I'll just say.
I think the last word.
Yeah, I just think there's one other piece, which, and I'm not sure what the right answer is here, but I think there is also, and I think there's been a lot of discussion around it, but the, I think, leniency or lack of severity when it comes to what happens to reckless drivers and what and when they get penalized, you know, how long are they off the road for? Do they get points? Do they lose their license? Do they go to jail? How long is that for? You know, certainly my wife's grandmother was, you know, hit by a drunk driver, for example, and, you know, hit and run and, you know, can't even find them. But I mean, for people that even do, is that, you know, is that crime and the punishment severe enough to act as a deterrent for future people not to engage in those behaviors as well? And certainly that, you know, more at the provincial level as well. But I think that's another point for discussion in this matter.
Kelly, last word on this. How do we fix this? Or do we even know how to fix this?
Yeah, I don't have the answers really to that. Another like issue I've seen too is I think over the pandemic we all gathered this sort of reliance on delivery services, and that's industry has exploded. One, I think because we got used to doing it, and then two, from the other side, I mean people are trying to make ends meet, right? They're trying to make a living, and that is a whole industry that is incentivized by speed. And so you have folks out there, you know, trying to get to the next one, the next delivery, the next delivery, you know, and maybe taking inappropriate shortcuts. We also, you know, have lots of delivery drivers who, you know, I see it on major thoroughfares. They just throw their four ways on and make everyone go around them, which is causing unsafe conditions sitting in bike lanes while they, you know, take the Chinese food into the into the apartment building, right? And they're in there for 5 minutes and come out. So I think there's lots of challenges around
that. It's not even a meal anymore. People are like ordering skip the dishes for like Dairy Queen blizzards. It's melted by the time it gets to you. Why are you doing that?
I know. So I think there's like all of these industries that have popped up that, you know, we're grappling with and how to deal with that. And so it's just like more, you know, hopefully some added enforcement will help. And perhaps when it comes down to like commercial ventures like that, you know, there's some opportunity from a regulatory perspective, national or provincial, to crack down on some of that stuff.
Let's talk about the LCBO before we wrap up. JP Hornick was warning members of OPSU this week that, hey, the province is going to sell off the LCBO. Doug Ford disputes that, says that's not something that's going to happen. Now, Doug Ford has said a lot of things that are going not going to happen, then they happened before. So I don't know how much people are necessarily going to be trusting him here. Do you think there's a real chance that they actually sell the LCBO? I have a significant problem with the beer store model, to be clear. I don't have much of a problem with the LCBO model. If the beer store was owned by the provincial government, I wouldn't have much of an issue with it. It's not. It's owned by foreign conglomerates. The LCBO is owned by the provincial government. I understand why that exists. Do we think that the government may actually sell this off? I can't see wanting to be the government that makes that decision. But again, Doug Ford has said stuff and that is not going to happen before, and then it happens. So
I'm disappointed. I thought this conversation was going to be about what you picked up at the LCBO last night for us to enjoy it at the podcast.
Sadly, no. I went out for sushi last night, but no LCBO stop.
You can't kill the goose that lays the golden egg.
Yeah.
When you're in government, you need that revenue. You know, we've already seen a loosening of alcohol sales, and you know, we've got LCBOs that are at the, you know, in more rural communities are at the back of a pharmacy or at the back of a convenience store or whatever,
and that's fine.
I've got no problem with that model.
Neither do I.
Yeah. I don't think that the LCBO is getting sold off by this government or any other government. It is a money making machine for them.
So is Hydro One. And someone sold that, but
yeah, Hydro One has some other.
Yeah, this is a different beast. I understand that.
It is. And as long as you've got these mechanisms that are controlling the import and export of alcohol, even across provincial lines, let alone international borders, I think that the government's going to want to retain this. I just can't see it being sold off. Loosening the rules for where you can get some stuff is one thing. Selling off a cash printing machine just doesn't make sense. And I think a lot of people like their local LCBO. I know some of the staff by name at mine in Argyle. I know if something's not on the shelf, who to go ask and ask if they've got any in the back room. And I mean, that happens in communities too. So I don't think we're going to see that go anywhere anytime soon.
I'm personally skeptical. And I think also, I have to think about the circumstances under where this is coming from, who's raising it.
Yeah, JB Hornick wants to, you know, fire up the membership. I understand that.
If there's wages of concern, if there's, you know, concerns because they're already loosening some of the rules, and hey, you know, am I going to have as many staff now, or is every LCBO going to need as many employees because, you know, X store elsewhere is now selling out and you know, taking away from their business. We'll see obviously what's going to happen when everything gets rolled out. And I have no idea what the impact, even to be honest, has been when grocery stores have had this available, but I don't think it's been that significant. Although I don't have the numbers on it. But you know, I think that's that individual's job and looking out for their members. And, you know, I think trying to put a little fear in people is certainly a tactic, but I think to Sean's point, like the LCBO is such an incredible entity for the provincial government to hold on to, especially from a revenue generation perspective. And I, you know, Hydro One example to me, that it's not the same, but I think a better example might be Highway 407. And I don't think you want to be that government that sells the LCBO and pins it on you for the rest of the days.
Because that's still hung on the Harris people.
There's still seller remorse from that decision.
And that is hung on the Harris people every time it's brought up. Remember when you idiots sold the 407? Which, like, fair enough. It was a very stupid choice. Yep. And now we're locked in, what is it, 100 years or something? An absurd amount of time. Kelly, this is interesting from a few perspectives. One that I was wondering about, though, is does the future of the LCBO get altered? Just because we see all these surveys that younger generations, just drinking is not as much of a thing for them as it was for the generations prior. And I'm just wondering what that looks like for the future of the LCBO's business model and how that works. That's years down the road. But I don't know if you notice the same
thing. That's because they're not old enough to have kids yet to need to drink.
Well, I have a 23-year-old who does not drink.
Okay.
And many of their friends don't drink.
Just by a choice, it's just not something they're into, and that's it. Are some of them into cannabis?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay. That's okay. So there you go.
It's replacing one thing with the other, right?
Which is fine, and I think some would argue healthier, but yeah. So,
I think that is something like the whole industry is grappling with, like the entertainment industry, bars. You go to see a band, and you're having a Coke, and that's not bringing in the bottom.
That's
line
not anymore, the economic right? model that this business has been built on.
So that's where you see like new businesses popping up, like Banquet, like other Tilt, where there's another way to get some revenue in the door besides relying on sale of alcohol.
Yep.
Because it is definitely a trend. I think LCBO has listened to that trend, and you see a lot of a big variety of alcohol-free products now in their stores that you can't really get anywhere.
Yeah.
Besides, some specialty online retailers. So I think, they're going to have to shift their business model because it definitely is a trend that that we're seeing.
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you, Tilt makes liquor sale profits off of me every time I get the urge to play Pac-Man.
There you go.
I appreciate that they got draft taps in there too.
They have NBA Jam in there. And that is my game when I go to the point where my kids get annoyed because they want to do other things. I'm like, no, hold on a second. Like, Charlotte doesn't get a chance to beat the Bulls all the time.
But I also think, like you go down Richmond Row on a Friday or a Saturday night, there are still lineups to get into Jack's and the Seeps and Cools. And so, there's still a lot of people who are going out to consume alcohol. They're still having a couple pre-drinks at home.
But I think there are now people in those lines who are not going to drink when they get inside. Yeah.
Yes, because...
And that's the interesting part.
Well, one of the positives of that is that some of those folks are there because they're being responsible as designated drivers to get people home safe.
Which is good.
And I appreciate the fact that there are people who are going to do that too. So, but I just think when you think about the LCBO and its future, if the province is really looking to divest itself of some bureaucracy, I've got a suggestion for them. The Catholic School Board would be a much better choice.
I would second that idea. We'll see how that goes. I think we might run into a dead end there because of a lack of political courage, but I agree. I think it's a great idea. I think we'll...
And it's not generating that much revenue for them.
No, it is not. In fact, it's the other way. Let's wrap up here just because we're up against the clock and Kate's going to come back in the studio here. But thank you very much to Kelly and to Jared and to Sean for doing the Friday Roundtable with us this week. Of course, you can find the Craig Needles podcast at classicrock981.com and londonnewstoday.ca. You can also find us wherever you get your podcast. And do remember that the Craig Needles podcast is powered by our friends over at Downtown London and at the Covent Garden Market.
The Craig Needles podcast is a presentation of the Blackburn Media Podcast Network.